Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The latest installment of the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, features Carrie Fisher's final performance as Princess Leia Organa. Carrie lived a full life. In addition to acting, she was also an acclaimed writer and feminist icon. She was open about her struggles with drugs and mental illness. Carrie died suddenly of cardiac arrest on December 27, 2016. She was 60. Biographer Sheila Weller has written about Carrie Fisher's remarkable life, from Hollywood royalty to Princess Leia and beyond, in Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Sheila talked about Carrie's famous parents, movie star Debbie Reynolds and singer Eddie Fisher.
She had a lot of privilege around her, a lot of glamour. And also there was a big scandal that erupted when she was about 2 years old. Her father kind of ran off with Elizabeth Taylor, who was a family friend. Their marriage had been the perfect 50s marriage, so to speak. The adorable girl from Texas, who was a singer-dancer, and the handsome crooner from Philadelphia. She was very Christian. He was Jewish. I think America in the conventional 50s was happy that they could break one little taboo by watching this adorable couple marry across regional and religious lines. But they were the adorable couple in movie magazines and in other magazines. And then suddenly he fell in love with this beautiful woman who had just been widowed, and everything erupted. I mean, it was an extraordinary scandal. You know, in America, it was a story that housewives and everybody kind of sunk their teeth into. And Carrie grew up with lights flashing, you know, in her eyes as a little girl with paparazzi on the front lawn. Mm-hmm. I think her grandfather once yielded a rifle against the paparazzi. So it was a huge public event, and it also was a hurtful event. Her father left her and her mother.
Yeah. Most of us first came to know of Carrie Fisher from her role as Princess Leia Organa in George Lucas's 1977 blockbuster Star Wars. And she played an aggressive and assertive heroine, not a damsel in distress type.
Right.
Did Lucas write the character of Princess Leia this way, or is this something that Carrie brought to the role?
That's a good question. She certainly brought it. Later, she started improvising her own lines, and she would go to be in movies and immediately tear up the script, and the producers and directors thought and actors thought what she was doing was much better than was on the page. But at the beginning, she was not a writer. She was a young girl. But she had an attitude, a hauteur, that gave her that non-damsel in distress attitude. And it worked. And young women who saw it saw a, you know, whether they used the word or not, consciously or unconsciously, they saw a feminist heroine in that role. She took a lot of licks for the guys. She was stronger than they were in many ways. She was a princess, so she had that grandeur about her. And she got into dangerous situations and got herself out of them, and she killed Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, and she had that iconic hairstyle, the kind of buns on the, mm-hmm. both sides of her head. There's that line in Star Wars, The Last Jedi, the scene where Princess Leia is being reunited with her long-lost brother Luke, and that great line that she says to him.
I know what you're going to say. I changed my hair.
It's nice that way.
Carrie met singer-songwriter Paul Simon while she was filming Star Wars, and they dated from 1977 until 1980 and then broke up, and then they got back together and they married in August 1983. What was their relationship like?
She met him, I think, through Richard Dreyfuss. I think he might have come to see her in Star Wars as well. There are two versions of that. Richard told me that he introduced them. She had been singing Bridge Over Troubled Water in grammar school and in high school and in Las Vegas and in London with her mother. That was her favorite song. She adored his music and his literacy. They were both short, and she made jokes about that. Don't stand next to me. They'll think we're salt and pepper shakers. They were both very verbal and witty. He was calmer. He was more serious. She was much younger and incredibly smart. People said you could see the infatuation. It was incredibly strong. She was very self-assured, and she had her own money, she had her own privilege, she had her own sophistication. He wasn't used to that kind of package, people said. Mm. He had other women who were strong and other women who were interesting and sophisticated, but not quite as young and as full of just dynamism and questions about the world and a kind of turbulence of the soul that Carrie had. So she was challenging in a number of ways, and he was definitely the calmer one. She said later that she felt a bit less than around his sophisticated friends. She hadn't finished high school. She only left in her junior year, so she almost finished and did some remedial school in New York, but felt a little insecure about that. But everybody thought she was incredibly smart. But it was a relationship that was full of love.
Mm. As you write in your book, Carrie said that the bad thing about their relationship was that they were similar animals. How so?
I think she said in a relationship you need a plant and a waterer. And we were both plants. We both needed watering. They both had demands. She had a big ego. She had a big sense of herself. She wasn't just somebody who was going to help a man and be kind and sweet and gentle and, you know, yes, dear, what do you want? No, dear, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And even though he was a representative of the new generation and the counterculture and the literate counterculture, men in the 70s still had the template of earlier generations. And that would last for a long time, which was that the woman is a little bit beholden to you, that you're a little bit the primary person in the relationship. So I think that was challenging for him. And she wrote about that and talked about that.
Can you talk a bit about Carrie Fisher's overuse of drugs and how that impacted her life?
It impacted her life quite a bit. Her father was an addict, I think we can say that. He had a predisposition to overuse of drugs. There's a genetic link to it. It's not always that way, but I think in her case it was. In the 70s, you know, a lot of people were doing cocaine as a quote-unquote recreational drug. Some people like Carrie and John Belushi, for them, it couldn't have been just a recreational drug. It was something that was hard to give up. And also, she had bipolar disorder, which was then called manic depression, but it wasn't diagnosed as such. So during manic stages, she would take what was then called painkillers and now are called opioids. So it was challenging for her, and she fought it and gave into it and fought it and gave into it for much of her life.
And I believe that the diagnosis of bipolar 2 or manic depression, that came in 1981 when she overdosed on the set of a film Under the Rainbow that she was making with Chevy Chase. Is that right?
That was the first one. Yes, she rejected that diagnosis. And later, after another overdose, she accepted it, was very clean for about 11 months and took it very seriously, you know, and accepted the diagnosis indeed.
In 1987, Carrie released her first book, Postcards from the Edge, a semi-autobiographical novel. Why did she decide to write this book?
Well, I think she always wanted to be a writer. As a young girl, she read the great writers. She really admired Dorothy Parker and others. And after this and a couple of other books, she said, I'm not an actor who writes, I'm a writer who acts. It was gathering in her. First, she was going to write a book called Money Dearest, which was kind of a funny take on growing up in Beverly Hills, but she thought that was a little too sardonic. I think the situation with the overdose and her strong understanding and witty understanding of being a woman in Hollywood, being a woman at that time and place, what the Hollywood culture was like, her own sense of the world came together, and she wanted to write it, and she did.
In your book, you include an excerpt from Postcards from the Edge in which Carrie describes what it felt like to live in her brain. Could you read this for us?
Mm-hmm. She lived in her head like a madwoman locked in a tower, hearing the wind howling through her hair and waiting for someone to come and rescue her from feeling things so deeply that her bones burned.
Thank you. That's very powerful.
Yeah.
Now, this will really, really impress you. I am in the abnormal psychology textbook. How cool is that? Now keep in mind, I am a Pez dispenser and I'm in the abnormal psychology textbook. Who says you can't have it all?
In 2006, Carrie put together a one-woman stage show with writer-director Joshua Ravitch. The show was called Wishful Drinking. Can you tell me a bit about that show?
Yes, that was a wonderful show. It went on for years. She had a board with a pointer of her crazy family and all the relationships. She talked about being weight shamed, being age shamed. She made fun of herself in a way that was so hilarious. Women especially midlife women, felt relief in it. They felt, here was a celebrity who was making fun of the same things that I feel secretly ashamed of, being overweight, being older than I would like to be.
Well, but here's the thing. As you age, it's about dignity. You know what I mean? This is what you have to look forward to. It's really unavoidable. George Lucas ruined my life. I mean that in the nicest possible way. And now, he hardly talked at all. When I got this job, they told me that I had to lose 10 pounds. Well, I weighed about 105 at the time. Well, no, but to be fair now, I carried about 50 of those pounds in my face. So you know what a good idea would be, though? Give me a hairstyle that further widens my already wide face.
She took herself to task. She talked about the quote-unquote contract she signed to look always the way she looked in the metal bikini. And she said, clearly, I broke the contract. You know, so when you're young and beautiful and thin, and that is an iconic portrait, and you change and you grow and you live and you go through challenges and you gain weight, it's hard when you're a public figure. And this was when social media was beginning and getting very active. And she became a big Twitterer, especially toward the end of her life. But it was painful to have people say things like, Carrie Fisher used to be so hot, now she looks like Elton John.
Oh, it's terrible.
And she spoke about that in Wishful Drinking, yeah. So she made fun of it, but toward the end of her life, it was sad to her.
Yeah, and it was a big hit, right? Audiences responded really well to Wishful Drinking.
Big hit all over the world. And she did it when she was in the middle of many challenges. She had ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, in the middle of that period of time. And it was amazing. I think she never missed a performance.
Wow.
She had a lot going on, but like her mother, she was unsinkable. The show must go on.
The unsinkable Molly Brown, the unsinkable Carrie Fisher. An HBO documentary called Bright Lights, starring Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, was released a couple of years ago. What can we learn from this film about Carrie's relationship with her mother?
How complex and deep and loving it was. It was a beautiful documentary. You saw Debbie struggling. She was ill at the time. She wanted to keep performing. You saw that Iron Maiden in Debbie and Carrie learning from Debbie, Debbie learning from Carrie, them going together when Debbie won one of her major awards and Carrie being so awed and appreciative that her mother won the award. They had had a turbulent relationship earlier on, especially when she was in London going to college at the Central School of Speech and Drama. So this showed how incredibly close they became in the final years, maybe the final couple of decades of their lives.
I don't know what to go.
Coming up one of these days, you will see me.
I don't know the song.
I'll be around.
I think I'm my mom's best friend, more than a daughter. My mother really wants me to be an extension of her wishes, an extension of her. And to a great degree, far more sometimes than I ever would want to, I know what my mother feels and wants. And there's a lot of it.
And they lived in two houses in one compound in Coldwater Canyon. And they were just amazingly close. And a lot of women who saw it thought, that's a version of me and my mother in one way or another.
It resonated with them.
Right.
Can you take us through the last day of Carrie Fisher's life and tell us what happened?
Well, the night before, she had dinner with Salman Rushdie, her friend, and Sharon Horgan, with whom she was in Catastrophe. She had a good evening, according to these two people, although there was a sadness about her that was developing. She said to Sharon Horgan at one point, I'm sorry that I didn't hold it together better with her looks, words to that effect. The next day, she got up, went to the airport to take a plane to L.A., and she had a seizure, fortunately close to landing in L.A. It wasn't in the middle of the flight. And there was an episode of sleep apnea, and it brought on a heart attack. And she was taken immediately to the hospital, was put on some sort of life support for a couple of days, and then she died.
And her mother, Debbie Reynolds, died the day after.
Yes,
Carrie.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Everybody sort of made of it kind of Shakespearean, biblical. You know, according to Todd Fisher, it was almost destined to happen. Debbie had been very sick the last year, and Carrie was taking care of Debbie. And worried about Debbie. And Debbie had been worried about Carrie kind of all of Carrie's life. Carrie had that intense personality, that complexity that was the undiagnosed bipolar. And Debbie knew that she had periods of great vulnerability and said once, and I quoted it twice in the book, if I could, I would suffer for her. You know, Todd Fisher has said that was something that was inevitable, that she felt it was her time to go. And I think a lot of people who knew their relationship kind of understood that.
Sheila Weller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheila Weller is the author of Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Find out more about Sheila and the remarkable life of Carrie Fisher at WPR.org/beta.
You do absolutely no sound, so you're leaning forward, and then she looks up and you hear her breath, and then the wings of the birds come at you, and you're just like, you just want to duck, you know? It's so frightening.
Director Midge Costin joins us to talk about her documentary, Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.